Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Stuff to blow your mind, New York Comic Con, Stranger Things. Yes, it all comes together on October 6th from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Hudson Mercantile in Manhattan. If you're in the area, join us for Stuff to Blow Your Mind live, Stranger Science, as we explore the exciting science and tantalizing pseudoscience underlying the hit Netflix show Stranger Things. Stuff You Missed in History Class has a show right after us in the same venue, so you can really double down on your stuff. And hey, the three of us would love to meet you. This is the opportunity to do it. Learn more and buy your tickets at NewYorkComicCon.com/NYCC-presents.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And, you know, we had a recent episode, R. Scott Baker, on alien philosophy and fantasy, and we chatted with Canadian author R. Scott Baker about his recent paper on alien philosophy, which published in the Journal of Consciousness Studies. And in that paper, he reconstructed human philosophy while trying to imagine the philosophy of an alien civilization. And he also discussed his ongoing, heady, dark fantasy saga, The Second Apocalypse, leading into the publication of Book 7, The Unholy Consult.
The magic number.
Yeah. Fast forward to today. Well, The Unholy Consult has been out for a couple of months. I read it. I ended up reaching out to Scott, was chatting with him about the book, and we decided, hey, let's just have him come back on the show for a bonus episode.
Right. So this will be bonus, not part of our regular rotation, because it's going to be about some esoteric interests. Part of it will be following up on our recent discussions about the origins of consciousness. So we're going to talk to him about consciousness, about philosophy, about artificial intelligence, but also, since we get pretty deep into the weeds about his books and the spoiler-laden discussion, we thought we would pull this one out as a bonus excerpt.
That's right. And there will be a spoiler warning. So if you have not, if you were concerned with spoilers for Scott's books, and particularly if you're concerned with spoilers for The Unholy Consult, don't worry. We'll give you a heads up before we proceed. Now, Just to refresh, Scott's fiction explores philosophical and neuroscientific concepts through fantasy, science fiction, even detective fiction. And his second apocalypse saga follows the rise of essentially a thinking machine human prophet on a world plagued by an alien evil that leverages both sorcery and ancient technology in a war to shield itself from the damnation of the gods.
That's a pretty good sell, Robert.
Yeah, well, that's in a nutshell. I'm a big fan, so you know I was happy to chat with Scott about the books in particular and some of the metaphysics and philosophy involved there. But of course, as previously, he was more than happy to just dive in on anything related to consciousness, philosophy, or you know the grim nature of our future.
Well, I guess without further ado, we will now take you to our conversation with R. Scott Baker.
Hey, Scott, welcome back to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with us again. I guess we'll just start off with a general, how's it going, and have you fully recovered from your recent eye surgery?
Yeah, the eye surgery has gone off without a hitch, which is great, and I definitely can see much better than I could just even a few weeks ago.
Cool. Yeah, because I think you said you had to you were basically in a prostrate position, healing for a few days.
Yeah, they performed something called a vitrectomy, and you know, at first, because eyes, everything to do with eyes, absolutely freaks me out. I didn't bother to do the obligatory Google search. I didn't even want to know, figuring that ignorance was bliss. And so, I mean, I had a retinal tear, and this was actually secondary to that. And so I assumed that it would be the same kind of surgery. And it was endoscopic, so I was thinking it was going to be endoscopic. But what they did is they actually take all the vitreous jelly inside of your eye. They shell your eye like a Concord grape.
Oh no.
And then they inject a saline solution and a gas. And what you need to do is you need to keep your face down. In my case, it was only 72 hours, but some poor souls have to do this for longer than a week.
Oh.
And, you know, at first I thought, I spend so much of my time with my head down in a book that I thought, no problem, I'll just read for 72 hours straight. And, the first muscle spasm started after about 90 minutes, and it was just... it was a miserable, miserable experience.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. you know, messing with eyes makes me think about consciousness. I know we wanted to talk to you about consciousness today, but there's so much that our eyes do that makes us aware of how unconscious so much of our mental processing is. Like, you know, you often think of consciousness as synonymous with awareness, like what you have in your gaze. But, you know, I was thinking about the idea that the optic nerve is something that completely blocks part of your vision, and yet we totally don't notice that at all. Like our eyes just put the picture together and we have this perception of seeing things as they are, even though part of our visual field is totally occluded all the time in normally healthy eyes that are working as they should. And there's a lot about eyes that's like that. I'm thinking also of the idea of blind sight, where, you know, you can have somebody whose eyes are correctly feeding information to their brain and their brain is even processing it, yet they're somehow not aware of what they're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was uncanny just simply because of the blind brain theory. And it just felt like I was having a living demonstration of my theory played out for me in my visual field. Because what happens, I had some debris land on my retina, and I sleep like a vampire. I think that was the problem. And this debris, it feeds the retinal cells the same signal over and over and over again. And you know, when those cells get the same signal all the time, your visual processing centers start ignoring that information.
Right.
But what they don't do is tell the rest of your visual processing centers that information, you know, is missing. And so what I ended up seeing isn't, you know, a black spot in front of my visual field. What I ended up seeing is a visual field I mean, it looked like, you know, if your visual field were projected across the screen and someone were to just grab that screen and crinkle a big bunch of it in their fist.
Huh.
So everything, all that information was missing. All of it was occluded. That's what I would see. So, you know, if my right eye was dominant and I turned to look at my dog Mooney here, every once in a while, I'd look and he wouldn't have eyes.
Oh.
Because I would look to his eyes and it was right in my fovea, right in my center of my field of vision. And so I'd look to his eyes and his eyes would be missing. So it would just be fur down to his jaws. And it was a very disconcerting experience. I mean, the surgeon said I could wait because there's a chance it could dislodge and go away, but it was just freaking me out too much.
That's amazing. So just to clarify, you're saying there was no darkness, there was no white spot, there was no black spot, there was just a lack of sight.
Just a lack of sight. And
wow.
I mean, that's the cornerstone of the blind brain theory. The idea that there is, I mean, if you think about darkness, it's so interesting because darkness is actually a form of visual information. So our visual centers have evolved the ability to actually warn the rest of our visual processing centers to, you know, basically the absence of visual information. So we don't go into dark alleys because we know a dark alley is there. But imagine if you couldn't see darkness. I mean, imagine if you were blind to darkness. You would never be able to see a dark alley. A dark alley would be like my visual field. It would be absolutely occluded. You know, the two buildings you could see would be pinched together, right? And if you were to happen to trip between those buildings, you would find yourself in a region that you simply could not see. You couldn't even see that you couldn't see, in other words. So it's, it's a spooky analogy, but an apt one.
It makes us realize the way that we don't really see space. Like we think we see space, but really what we see does not take place in space except insofar as it takes place in the space between neurons.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it actually shows that, I mean, all this stuff, space, you know, inside, outside, you know, the whole way in which our sensorium is structured really... You know, I mean, technically, it is nowhere at all. I mean, it's not between your neurons. It's not outside of you, right? It really is a kind of recipe that we follow through that happens to help our body navigate space and what have you. But it's all, you know, statistical guesswork that we sort of post facto describe in ways that are easily interpreted as being, you know, naively real or what have you. I mean, that's kind of there's so many ways to cut that pie. You know, I mean, I think really the best thing to say is that when we start asking these kinds of questions of our experience, that really what we've done is we've tripped into crash space. We've sort of tripped outside the bounds of what that information was, you know, originally adaptively geared to problem solve. And we're sort of doomed to be confused when we pose those kinds of questions.
So, Scott, we recently recorded two episodes on Julian Jayne's The Origin of the Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, not because we're completely won over by it or anything, but just because we find it such a fascinating hypothesis.
Yeah, it's so radical. It seems like it's probably wrong, but I've almost never encountered a more interestingly presented hypothesis.
Yeah, so we were wondering, do you have any specific thoughts on Jayne's theory?
Well, this is something I read when I was an undergraduate about 30 years ago now, almost 30, well, a little less than 30 years ago. So I'd have to really rack the memory banks to remember the thesis. I mean, the thesis is basically the idea that At a certain point, in our past, we couldn't actually internalize, right, the different lines of communication going on in our brain, such that we automatically externalized voices and impulses or what have you, and blamed them on the gods, and that only over time were we able to actually internalize and to unify these various sources of information and recognize them as being endogenous. Is that roughly what his argument was?
Yeah, that's pretty close. So I can give a brief rundown on it because there are so many interesting threads to pull. So basically, Jane says that consciousness is only made possible by the presence of language, which gives us the ability to create metaphors. And he views consciousness as a metaphorical mind space based on the analogy of real space, in which this analog version of the self can observe and enact past events and hypothetical events in a process that Jane calls narratizing. Essentially, he means arranging mental content into a story with cause and effect and a timeline in this metaphorical space. And so he says, so that's what consciousness is now, but he says that that form of consciousness did not exist in humans until roughly 3,000 years ago, emerging possibly in Mesopotamia and spreading across the world through cultural contact since then. And that, yeah, like you said, before consciousness, basically when people encountered novel stimuli, whenever there was a stress point in their behavior that could not be responded to with basic instinct and, you know, conditioned signal behavior, they couldn't respond to it with those things. So instead, what they perceived was an auditory hallucination telling them what to do. And originally, in the earliest forms, this would have been a hallucination of like a dominant leader in the tribal group, or of a chief, or of a parent or something. But over time, these voices came to be perceived as otherworldly beings called gods. And so you have this three-stage evolution where early humans are non-conscious organisms controlled entirely by instinct and conditioning. And then you have the evolution of language, and that brings about the bicameral mind, where one half of the brain commands the other half what to do, and the other half routinely obeys without objection. And then finally, about 3,000 years ago, because of various stresses that he hypothesizes could have caused this, we have the consciousness revolution, where people instead begin to perceive of a mind space where they can work out hypothetical scenarios in this unreal space.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to reread that. I mean, remember the God stuff, everything that you said up until that point just sounds like Dennett to me. I mean, it sounds uncannily like Dennett, to the point where it kind of worries me that Dennett doesn't reference James.
I think Dennett has referenced James at some point, I recall. I don't know what book it was in, but I thought he had.
I mean, because that is very similar to the theory he lays out in his most recent book, from Bacteria to Bach and Back. Mm-hmm. Which is, it's kind of a retooling of the thesis he lays out in Consciousness Explained, which I also read way back when for the first time, and I don't think I understood years ago when it came out. I think it was, 1989, 1990, or maybe even later than that.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, but it's the same notion. And the same idea that it's not a colossal coincidence that all the things that we experience also happen to be the things that we can speak of, and that experience is kind of a linguistic palette that we use to interface not simply with other brains, but with our own brain as well. And that the types and forms of information that are available in this interface are so geared to their applications that it actually makes sense to talk about things like James is obviously discussing, you know, a transformation in consciousness or a transformation into consciousness, simply on the basis of the ways in which we linguistically categorize and apply the types of information that experience renders available. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, absolutely fascinating stuff. Definitely a kernel of truth, I think, in that way of looking at consciousness, definitely.
Yeah, I would say the book is definitely worth a reread, even though it, you know, like we say, you have to assume it's probably wrong because it's, it's so specific and it's so radical. But then again, I love how specific it is. I mean, so many theories of consciousness don't get that gritty about the cause and effect of the evolution of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's one of the things that's always like really, really struck me, as a philosophy student over the decades. Because I've gone through such huge conversions myself, right? You know, from, you know, being a 14-year-old, stumbling into, the problem of determinism, you know, without any sort of, you know, education to help me out, and becoming a naive nihilist, convinced that experience was completely an illusion. I mean, completely convinced. And,
I remember, you know, phases like that.
Doing all these drugs and just freaking out at, you know, what my own phenomenology seemed to be telling me. And then all of a sudden stumbling into Heidegger and being completely blown away in the opposite direction and suddenly feeling as though everything about me was steeped in meaning, in purpose. And this notion that I was almost like a deep sea submersible, making existence happen, right? Simply by being a interstice that forced whatever was being thrown my way into my projects, into my cares, right? Into my worries. And most importantly, into the structure of my own temporal existence, right? Having a future, having a past, having a now that it's statically combined all three. And then, of course, Derrida sort of blew that apart. And, you know, here I am now, back to where I was when I was 14 years old. And even though at each point I was almost evangelical as to what my experience was telling me, you know, there's just radical incompatibilities between all of those, you know, from my phenomenology being the very ontological foundation of my existence to my phenomenology being, you know, a deceptive assemblage of phantasms. I mean, how can it be both things at once? And how can it feel like it has to be that way to the same being at two different times? I don't know. Maybe James had something right about the collective progression of our self-understanding.
Well, one thing I like about what James offers is that he definitely does give an interesting secular accounting of how consciousness could be adaptive, how it could do something that's, you know, apart from just the helpless observer theory, the idea, as you know, that consciousness, yeah, it exists, there is phenomena, but it just observes what the body does without any power to change anything. According to James and his version of consciousness, consciousness is it's a metaphorical space in which we can work out hypotheticals, and this would not be available, you know, this kind of introspective simulation of behavior and case running and testing would not be available to organisms that did not have the power to introspect. I wonder what you think about that.
For me, it's like, you know, reflective consciousness. So when we engage in metacognitive deliberation, you know, I see that as being a, definitely in the terms we understand it as, you know, post-scientific humans. I see that as being deeply, deeply deceptive in a lot of ways. I mean, I think it's responsible for this explosion of philosophical interpretations, just like that little, you know, life story I gave you of my own interpretation of my phenomenology. That was born of basically humans reapplying their metacognitive capacity to experience in ways that those metacognitive capacities just simply never evolved to be applied, right? So you could say all philosophical reflection, in a sense, is a kind of misapplication of our metacognitive capacity. But still, it's enormously creative. You just got to look at the philosophical canon to see how creative it is. And out of, you know, that scholastic mountain of incompatible interpretations, you could argue that there's a great, great number of nuggets that have been taken away and taken up in all sorts of different ways that have ultimately profited humanity. I'm inclined to think that it's a accidental, a matter of dumb luck stumbling across, you know, some interpretation that actually ends up enabling something that becomes socially useful down the road. I don't know. I think there's just too much disagreement, too much fallow thinking for it, as far as I'm concerned, to be obviously practical in the way you're suggesting, James, is suggesting. I mean, otherwise, you know, all the ways we use it instinctively all the time, you know, catching your tongue, you know, when your mother-in-law says something at the dinner table, pondering for a second to remember where you put your keys, you know, taking a deep breath during a squash game to try to understand what it is you're doing wrong that's letting your buddy kick your ass. All those sort of natural applications of metacognition are very powerful and very effective. You know, the real questions arise when we take all those practical capacities and we start saying, solve this theoretical problem, solve that theoretical problem, and so on and so forth, especially in the absence of empirical information.
I'd imagine in Jane's version, the landscape in which it does arise is more the former, what you're talking about. You know, it's in day-to-day dealings. It comes not from people trying to solve big philosophical problems. You know, it wasn't Plato who invented consciousness, but people trying to deal with hectic novel stimuli in their day-to-day lives and figuring out how to survive them.
I mean, it'd be interesting to, I mean, this is the thing that I think vexes a lot of critics of Dennett, is this idea that, you know, if consciousness is a user illusion the way he insists it is, and if experience, you know, isn't, you know, real the way he seems to imply it is, I mean, he certainly doesn't believe that there's any such thing as qualia. And the question is, what is it? I mean, is it something that we just make up? You know, when I think about the redness of red, I mean, it seems as intuitively there as anything could possibly be. You know, but there's no such thing as qualia, Dan? How could that possibly be? And you could probably ask the same question of James, I'm sure. I mean, was red not red before we developed consciousness? Or how about animals? How about creature consciousness? Right? Do dogs have some sort of, you know, palette of visual awareness that is unique to them? I don't know. When you start asking questions about, you know, sensory consciousness and all these arguments as to, you know, the ways in which judgments make consciousness happen, as opposed to, say, impose interpretations upon, right, some kind of hile, some kind of consciousness, becomes very difficult for people to buy into, I think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think one of the things that contemplating this leads us to is that this question of like whether consciousness is one core event and phenomena, as Jaynes does seem to think it is, like for him, consciousness is one thing that he defines fairly specifically and fairly persuasively in some sense. But then again, you know, you look at people like Dennett and they would say, I guess, would Dennett say that consciousness is an assemblage of different mental phenomena that you are you're linking together and calling a single phenomena. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dennett, he's notoriously slippery when it comes to the mental, right? I mean, for him, you know, it's all interpretation all the way down. And, but at the same time, he wants to always insist that there's these real patterns that are motivating interpretations, right? So, when he talks about mental events, mental imagery, I mean, he says, of course, it's there. Right? But then when he talks about the things that philosophers want to say about mental events and mental imagery, it really starts to sound like he's saying it's not there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another thing that people find frustrating, trying to nail down his position. I actually think that what Dennett wants to say is that, close your eyes and imagine, you know, your favorite pet, you know, from your childhood, you know, as best you can. And, you know, then ask yourself, which way is the shadow falling across, you know, your pet's left paw, you know, is your pet's fur well groomed? Is there any blemishes of any kind? Is your pet perfectly still or is your pet moving? I mean, all these questions aren't the kinds of questions we normally ask of mental imagery. And so they kind of seem misplaced. Like, I'm not looking at a photograph or watching a video of my pet. I'm imagining my pet in my mind's eye. So you can just sort of see that whatever the information mental imagery provides, you know, it only has so many degrees of cognitive freedom, right? There's only so many different kinds of questions you can ask of it before the questions just kind of seem to start to miss the point or to obscure or confuse the matter. And if you take that, which seems pretty obvious with mental imagery, and then apply it to consciousness as a whole and say, well, what kind of questions can we ask of conscious experience? Then I think Dennett starts making a whole hell of a lot more sense, you know, because, there's books read, it looks red, you know, but qualia, what the hell do you mean by qualia? You know, this, because qualia is a categorization, right? It's a way to use metacognition to regiment experience. And that arguably isn't something that metacognition, you know, our ability to reference experience was ever designed to do. And so perhaps because of the way qualia creates so much confusion in so many areas of philosophy of mind, right? Perhaps qualia, it's just one of those things we should get rid of because it really doesn't belong to that set of questions that experience, you know, we have evolved to be able to answer of experience.
And just to clarify real quickly, so that term qualia might not be in everybody's toolkit.
Well, qualia is just the redness of the red,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's the supposedly private, ineffable character or quality. I mean, quality is a fancy way of saying quality. You know, what's the quality of redness? You know, if you want to just talk about that, you know, in abstraction from red or blue, or, you know, the orangeness of orange or the brightness of light or what have you, you can just use that term qualia instead. Categorization of sensory information as apparently presented in conscious experience.
If you don't mind, I think I got one more for you. I'll hand you back to Robert for a minute. Okay, so
this
would be one about preferences. Do you think consciousness is inherently preferable, or if you're comfortable putting a moral quality on that, is consciousness a thing to be morally preferred or deferred to? I mean, I think we obviously, whether or not it's right to do so, have a consciousness bias. Like, I would not want to be transformed into a being that has all the same qualities as me but is not conscious, because that seems, on the face of it, like it would be the death of my experience. And so, I mean, that does bring up some weird connotations with Jane's theory. I mean, if it were possible for there to be something like a human being except not conscious, would we think that that being had the same kind of rights that we did? Would it be just as good for beings like that to inhabit the universe?
Yeah, so for me, these questions are they're kind of almost quintessential crash-based questions, right? These are the kinds of questions that moral reason, as the set of rough and ready heuristics that we use to actually navigate social and moral problems, just simply really it wasn't equipped to be able to answer decisively one way or the other. Which is why they sort of have this quality of being constantly problematic, and never finding any sort of determination whatsoever. I'm not saying that the question shouldn't be asked, because it's absolutely fascinating, and it is the case in our lives that we defer to experience all the time. You just look at survivors of the Holocaust. I mean, the moral authority that a Holocaust survivor possesses by virtue of having suffered, having experienced what they experienced, is a powerful thing. It has a palpable influence on individuals, particularly in the company of those people. But what if you're talking about a zombie who suffered the Holocaust? Now notice, even just putting it, framing it in these terms actually kind of tickles. It almost feels like you're treading upon something sacred, right?
Mm-hmm.
A zombie suffering the Holocaust seems to trivialize what these people suffered in the concentration camps during World War II, right? I mean, even simply posing that theoretical question on a matter so morally charged, simply because of the experiences underwriting it, makes you sort of pause and worry, right? But the question itself is still an honest question. I mean, would we worry about someone who had no experiences? In other words, who simply could not suffer. They could generate suffering behavior, but they actually never felt any suffering. Would we view them the same way we would view a Holocaust survivor? And the answer's got to be no, of course not, right? That person's just a zombie. Morality, whatever it is anchored in experience. And to the point where moral intuitions are social, it makes a tremendous amount of sense, given Jane's thesis that consciousness is, in some sense, linguistic. Insofar as, you know, it's our social communications of experiences that we use to primarily communicate, you know, moral urgency, moral import, or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, that just leads to a very troubling conclusion, I guess, that would draw from, if you were to give any credence to Jane's and say that his picture of the evolution of consciousness is correct, it would be to basically say that there was not much of anything morally worth anything on Earth until about 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a question that is an absolutely pressing question when it comes to animal rights. I mean, animal rights advocates presume that, you know, animals deserve, warrant the same moral consideration as humans do, simply because animals suffer, and feel and experience as humans do. But if it's the case that consciousness, you know, is actually linguistic, then you'd have to say that animals have no consciousness, in which case then really human morality doesn't seem to apply to them at all. And that's, I mean, for a lot of people, those are fighting words. I mean, I learned some time ago not to raise potential quagmire in certain company, because some people get really upset very fast when you suggest that their dog isn't conscious.
Well, that gives you some social reasons for resisting Jane's thesis, in addition to the questions you have about its rigorous merits.
yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is, and I mean, Dennett even discusses this in from Bacteria to Pocket Back. I mean, the bottom line is that if you're going to be, sort of empirically tough-minded about this, you can't let, your moral intuitions or even, your cherished conceits bear on the question of whether or not animals have conscious experience or not, right? I mean, it's a real question, and it's not resolved. And it won't be resolved until we know what the hell consciousness is. And even though a great many people are, entirely convinced that animals have to have conscious awareness, science has this horrific history of overthrowing our most cherished conceits and beliefs. So, all you can do is buckle up and cross your fingers.
Well, I think we're going to have to go into the robot landscape of the future, maybe on the moral maxim that if you're not sure whether a thing has consciousness or not, you should treat it like it does.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty good rule of thumb. I mean, it's certainly the rule of thumb I use. And I have about as dismal a view of consciousness as you could possibly have.
Well, so far we've been talking about the potential. We've been talking about the mind state of animals. We've been talking about the potential mind state of earlier humans. Now, Scott, in your Second Apocalypse novels, you present the mind states of essentially earlier humans, sort of medieval humans, I guess you'd say, as well as a number of alternate creatures, alien entities like the Inkarai, various weapons races that the Consult has created to wage war against the natural inhabitants of the world. For listeners out there who aren't familiar with your work, there's the Shrank, or Shrank, how do you prefer it to be pronounced?
Well, I mean, I have no preference. I call him Shrank myself.
Okay.
I don't worry about the pronunciation.
Okay. Yeah, so for listeners who aren't familiar, these are essentially like an orc-like warrior species. And then you have the Skin Spies, which are a face-changing infiltration unit. How did you envision the cognitive processes of these in human beings? And are they truly conscious?
Yeah, I mean, one of the conceits for the Shrank and the Skin Spies is that they have no consciousness whatsoever. They don't suffer. I mean, so they go through all the motions, right? They produce all the behavior that cues our interpretation of conscious states, but they don't actually possess those conscious states. And then, so the idea is that they kind of, in a strange way, as a result, stand outside of our notions of morality. And I mean, at points, I try to play with the reader's intuitions with regards to this, because they suffer, or they look like they suffer. And so, I mean, I thought it was, given the way I try to basically press, as many moral intuitions as I possibly can to their breaking point by the end of the series. It just seemed like a great, vehicle to use to cue certain intuition and then to, subvert them, take them away. They're nasty things regardless.
I mean, this kind of thing seems possibly relevant in the real world. If you imagine, again, I mentioned the future robot landscape, a future where humans wage wars with
robot soldiers or something like that, have, you know, some kind of robotic warfare machines. I mean, I wonder if people at some point will say, you know, it's best to make these things look like they're really suffering when they get damaged in order to exploit our enemy's humanity and desire not to hurt them.
Yeah, that's a great hook for a science fiction story right there. I mean, if you look at the Boston Dynamics robots that they have, I mean, there's something uncanny about them, right? Uncanny about the way they move. You know, the quadruped ones I find to actually be the most unnerving of all. They just seem organic. There's something organic about them that, once again, just simply pushes your buttons, right?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, Sherry Kirkle, she's been using this term for quite a while, but it comes up, I think, in Alone Together as well. She talks about Darwinian buttons in human-computer interaction. And the consistent finding across the field is that it's incredibly easy to cue our, you know, heuristic tendencies to project, you know, or anthropomorphize, you know, inanimate things or animals or what have you. It's really easy to get us to look at things as having a mind. And I guess the best example of that is the Heider-Simmel illusion. You can look it up online easily enough. I mean, it's just triangles and circles and squares, and there's a hollow square that looks like it has a door, and it's just really, I mean, objectively, it's just, you know, these triangles in this circle dancing around on the screen. That's all the information you get, and yet your brain turns it into a soap opera, you know, with this father trying to keep his daughter from this lover who persists and will not leave her to the devices of this evil father triangle. And
ultimately, it's like Flatland.
It's Flatland, only, you know, geared to the human tendency to turn shapes into soap operas. So little information is required, and what that means in terms of artificial intelligence is that it really actually is easy for designers of artificial intelligences to push our Darwinian buttons. They just got to figure out where they are. And one of the creepiest things I came to realize, I think over the past 3-4 years or so, is the degree to which the research that's being done in human-computer interaction is basically directed at us, and is discovering, you know, tremendous things about who we are as human beings, because by knowing what these buttons are, we can actually design machines more effectively to simulate the presence of experience, the presence of mind, the presence of intentionality. And as a result, you know, we can make humans more at ease or more willing to open their checkbooks, right? Or more disinclined to go to the local polling station to vote. I mean, right. It is very, very troubling. And so for me, the big question that arises out of robots and AI isn't, you know, the question about, you know, battling robots in the battlefield. It's more of an ecological question. You know, if you see humans as basically pushing each other's Darwinian buttons all the time, blindly, and in ways that are completely adaptive, because we basically evolved to track and understand and cooperate. But the big thing is once you see things in terms of humans having these Darwinian buttons, and you understand that, you know, these Darwinian buttons are what allow us to explain, understand, manipulate one another. You understand then that, you know, human social ecology is actually a really, really delicate, finely tuned thing, as delicate as any ecology in any sphere of biology. And you start looking at things like AI. But anyways, you understand that human social ecology is as delicate as any other ecology, and that what, you know, artificial intelligences constitute is basically a form of invasive species, right? I mean, you know, these things, Microsoft's already selling them conversational user interfaces. Within just a few years, they're going to, you know, replace every human in every call center on the planet. You know, they're going to spread as quickly as anything spreads in the technological world. So inside of 10 years, you know, you're going to have spam AI. You know, I mean, we're talking about a flood of algorithms that are designed, right, to push our Darwinian buttons. In other words, fool us into treating them as being something that actually arises from the ancestral ecologies that we actually adapted to solve, right? So, I mean, for me, this is, you know, the beginning of the final stage of the semantic apocalypse, right? And this is the whirlwind, the point at which human meaning just simply becomes unworkable in any sort of traditional sense. It's, the ecology that requires it to function is going to be, it's going to collapse, right? I just don't see any way around it.
I mean, it's kind of scary imagining how we would have to defend ourselves against machines that push our Darwinian buttons, because it seems like the main way to do that would be to desensitize ourselves to our Darwinian buttons, which would mean desensitizing ourselves to the actual needs of other conscious beings among us.
And just accusing everyone of being a robot.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, to desensitize ourselves to each other. I mean, that's the kind of the bottom line, right? So social ecology, or all of our social interactions are ecological. And I mean, this is hard for people to grasp because it's completely invisible to them, right? I mean, it's completely occluded. This aspect of our interaction is utterly invisible to experience. When we talk to someone, we don't see ourselves as pushing Darwinian buttons. We don't look at it in any remotely material way or biological way whatsoever. But we are biological creatures. So ultimately, that's what it all runs on. And so any, you know, material invasion of that ecology is going to disrupt that ecology, right? So you put a bunch of cognitive technologies in our human social ecology, they will progressively disrupt it. They will alter it. They'll change it. And heuristic cognition, being, you know, circumstance dependent the way it is, I mean, it takes things, it only operates by taking background regularities for granted. You know, as soon as you start mucking with those background regularities, in this case, basically only having, you know, biological intelligences, we could take so much for granted just simply because our intelligence is really the model for all intelligence around us, including animal intelligence, right? I mean, we'll share far more in common with our dogs than we will with these conversational user interfaces. And the fact that our Darwinian buttons are so easily pushed means that they don't actually have to be all that smart to fool us. So we don't have to worry about super intelligence. I mean, you know, we'll be at each other's throats long before we ever get to the point where the singularity takes off. this is one of the things I hate about the AI debate as you, you know, see it popularized. It's bonkers, right? You got to improve the user experience. Everything's great on the one end, and then you have Skynet on the other, right? When really all the problems are in between.
Like it underestimates our vulnerability to simple stuff.
Exactly. It completely underestimates our vulnerability, right? I mean, and, you know, historically speaking, we've only ever caught on to the fact that we're doing, you know, horrific ecological damage after that damage is, you know, well apace, right? And if we, you know, fall into that pattern again with this, then, like I say, this is the whirlwind. This is the semantic apocalypse in the final stage, right?
Well, I have one more question before we get into more like spoiler territory for the Unholy Consult. So it's worth mentioning in all of this that while modern neuroscience and psychology works upon the assumption that the gods do not speak to us, in your second apocalypse saga, the gods are real and sometimes do speak. Can you provide an overview for how the gods function in a fictional universe that where you've put so much thought into the inner workings of consciousness and philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, the conceit's actually kind of embarrassingly simple. I mean, ultimately, I mean, it's the gods are, you know, in a sense, the drives, you know, the heuristic modules, right? The subpersonal processes that are constantly underwriting, you know, sometimes undermining, sometimes making possible, right, the workspace of consciousness, which is the world, which is physical reality in my books. And so, you know, the whole series is itself an analogy or allegory for ancient anthropomization of the universe and the cosmos, right? Only as, you know, projected given a modern understanding of, you know, the way in which cognition works. System two, which is reality. System one, which is all the subpersonal processes, right, that are constantly impinging upon system two, the deliberative reality of conscious experience. And then, you know, to crib the term from Neil Lawrence, system zero, which lies outside of that inside outside, which of course is the no god.
All right. Well, I think that means we should probably get into
the. That's too big of a spoiler.
No. I think we should. That signals that we should get into the some of the spoiler discussions here. So
here be warned.
Yes, here be warned.
If you haven't yet read Scott's books and you plan to, you may depart
in the seventh book. So the seventh book to your second apocalypse saga came out this summer, completing, I guess you'd say, the second movement of the saga and bringing the action to Golgotharoth, which the focal point of evil in your world and kind of mirrors the significance of Mordor's Barad-dûr in Lord of the Rings. First of all, just how long have you envisioned the resulting battle and the resulting showdowns, and did it come together as you imagined it would?
The idea, I mean, the boilerplate idea with this standoff with Kelleth and the consult at Golgotharoth, I came up with when I think I was 17, 18 years old, when I was just a wee little punk. And I have basically been obsessing over it for, what, 33 years now. I have snippets that I've written 20 years ago, snippets that I've written 30 years ago, snippets that I've written 3 years ago. I mean, it's been basically my obsession for my entire adult life. And you know, the prospect of actually writing the conclusion terrified me at first, just simply because I thought, you know, so much cogitation kind of whittled down to such a sharp point. It just seemed impossible to me. And I was afraid that I would freeze like a deer in the headlights. But for whatever reason, I mean, the gods wrote it, basically. It's one of the strangest sustained writing experiences in my life. I mean, I literally felt like I was just simply channeling. I mean, there's a rough draft. I mean, there's a lot of reflection that goes into the many, many subsequent drafts. But there was a period of over a year where I would just sit in front of the screen and my fingers would tap out this stuff, and I would marvel. And in that sense, my subpersonal processes, right, the gods underwriting my own conscious experience, were in charge of the whole show.
Well, as readers know at this point, Kellis basically unites most of the world in this effort against the consult, in this effort against the forces of the apocalypse, and fails. The book ends in just the complete defeat of these forces of the greater good that have been marshaled.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, if we go with the analogy that the gods were speaking to you, was there any kind of last temptation where there was a temptation to provide, I guess, provide the sort of ending that I seem to think some readers, I don't know how they ended up expecting it, but some of the divisive responses have seemed to line up with some expectation that I guess your future writings in this world would just be a victory lap for Kellis. But was there a temptation at all to provide that kind of ending?
I don't know. You know, the thing is that, because basically the idea is to, you know, bring the reader along, you know, as viscerally as possible. And, you know, so, you know, to have their, you know, moral confusion, match, you know, to resonate with the moral confusion of the characters in the book, right? To have, you know, their revulsion to resonate with the revulsion of the characters in the book, and also to have their hopes resonate with the hopes of the characters in the book. And then, you know, I mean, the no god is, you know, the event, the point at which meaning is done, right? It's over. No such thing as destiny, you know, no such thing as contact with God. It is the point where meaning itself breaks down. And the reader is, you know, reading a narrative of this story where meaning breaks down. In other words, they're actually, you know, participating in this narrative of the death of meaning via meaning. And, you know, the whole idea of having that meaning just cut short. I mean, you know, especially when I was younger, I mean, it just seemed like the greatest idea that anybody had ever had in the history of the human race. Mm-hmm. Which many ideas do. They seem like that when you're a teenager, I guess. But I mean, I've been committed to that right from the very beginning. And I knew it would piss people off. I knew, you know, because it's funny. I mean, you know, when you look at the reviews on Amazon, especially, you see 1 star, 5 stars, 1 star, 5 stars, 1 star, 1 star, 5 stars, 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just the book divides readers in what I think for any writer has to be a very commercially alarming way. But, I don't know, like I say, you know, to my wife, who's constantly bugging me to be more accessible. It's not like I have any control over it. Whatever say I had, I ceded a long time ago. This story's been in the driver's seat for quite some time.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, you know, revulsion and, you know, and our level of investment in the characters, because I certainly felt at the very end as things really turned to for the worse. I did feel a sense of revulsion and confusion. You know, I had so much within the context of reading the fiction. I had so much hope in Kellis that mm-hmm. afterwards I really had to process how I felt about what happened. But in processing, you know, I realized that, well, all of this is in keeping with the work. Like, I am supposed to feel this way. I'm not feeling this way about an error in a work or some sort of mm-hmm. failure in a work. I'm responding accordingly. And I feel like maybe some of the reviewers are they're reacting before they reach that point. Like, they're just having a visceral mm-hmm. reaction to the book, because I know they didn't just read The Unholy Consult. Like, they've been with you for 6 previous books. They know what you're about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it just goes to show, right? I mean, it's the power of narrative cognition. I mean, that's how powerful it is, right? I mean, a narrative that is denied resolution, right, is a narrative sin. I mean, it has its own, you know, internal logic, internal normativity that gives people, you know, the most intuitive yardstick that they could possibly have when it comes to judging a work, you know. So, you know, I mean, it's a fantasy series on purpose. You know, I mean, I wanted to write something that actually reached out to people, you know, like Theodore Beale, right? I mean, I know he's read my books, right? I think he's even recommended my books. And to me, that's a huge victory, because I think one of the biggest failures, you know, leading up to the circus that's Washington today is, you know, this belief on the part of the left that, you know, not engaging, you know, that I'm kicking everyone out of the backyard barbecue, right, would put an end to, you know, problems like racism, misogyny, and so on and so forth. When, you know, anyone I think who spends any amount of time on the web actually ranging outside of, you know, liberal in-groups can see just how not the case that is. I mean, for me, the web, this is something I've been arguing for years and years as well. I mean, how the web is undermining human social ecology. And I could go on for that for hours as well, but it's a fantasy because I wanted it to reach people who aren't otherwise exposed to things nearly so problematic as what you find in, you know, say, a David Foster Wallace novel, you know. So to read something infinite just like in a popular genre. And so I knew going in that a lot of people would be really pissed off. And I think you got it. I mean, some people, they sit back and they reflect and then they realize, yeah, whoa, right? Some people, they just follow that internal logic and they're like, this is garbage. I can't believe I wasted money on this fool. And other people are like, oh, okay, I get it. This is what you were trying to do. Yeah, well, you're just a pompous asshole, and they don't like it as well, right? And I understand all three responses, so, you know, and I don't necessarily disagree with that last one either. I mean, you know, it's a crazy project they set out to do. And, yeah, I don't know. I think it's worthwhile.
So in terms of the overall project, there is going to be a, there is going to be a third section to the saga. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I originally envisaged this, back when I was a punk, it was going to be a trilogy. It was going to be The Prince of Nothing, The Ashback Emperor, and then, you know, now I can say the name of the third book, The No God. The story idea only went up to the end of The Ashback Emperor. And I've never actually settled on what happens past that point. I mean, that point has always been the point where the narrative ends. And so, I mean, for me, if you think of the ending of the book, everyone, you know, is scattered and running from the whirlwind, wondering who survived and who died and what have you. I mean, that's exactly where I see myself. I mean, I'm with the readers here. I'm running from the whirlwind. I don't know who survived, who died. So this is the point where I become a discovery writer.
Oh, wow.
And I find out what happens after this point. But for me, it's weird to say, you have these huge projects that dominate so much of your imagination and so much of your life. And if you're, you know, sort of inclined to self-skepticism and pessimism the way I think I am, you just assume that something's going to happen. I mean, I always thought a map truck or something was going to slam into me. But I'd never be able to finish this, right? And so when I actually finished the book, and then when the book actually made it out on shelves, and I'm sitting there and I'm still alive, right? I'm still breathing, you know, I'm still not experiencing failure. it was a surreal moment, you know. It's almost kind of like one of these things where, you know, you don't plan for success. I just never really planned to actually, you know, get to this point where I'm, you know, post the Unholy Consult. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, I find it exciting, exhilarating, even in a lot of different ways. But it's a much different place to be for me as a writer. Much different place.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that you don't know the initial fates of many of the characters, because reading it, I'm thinking, oh, what happened? Did this character die? Are they going to survive what seemed to happen there? And then you kind of assume that. That Baker has a list set aside with check marks beside who survived and who didn't, but maybe not, and that's actually more.
It's all superposition.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. I mean, because it's not as though I haven't been, you know, writing. It's not as though, you know, post Unholy Consult scenes haven't come to my head, right? I mean, I have all kinds of scenes written, but they're not really compatible with each other. It's just been so many years, you know? I mean, it really is crazy if you think about it. I mean, to have a single story in your head for 33 years, right? I mean, that's a lot of notes. It's a lot of disorganization, a lot of uncertainty. So I really don't know.
So moving into the future, we can expect more books in the series, but what about other things you're working on? Can we expect any more Disciple Manning detective stories, any other works you're engaged in right now?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'd love to do is, I mean, I've had this idea for second Disciple Manning novel called The Enlightened Dead for years now. And I mean, I could really use a Disciple Manning novel right about now. But the Disciple of the Dog, I mean, people just don't really follow writers across genre lines, right? Hmm. Big creative event in my life. I mean, and oddly, you know, having this, you know, eye problem I had where the center of my visual field was occluded. I actually called that my little Kelnomus. It's a little part of my vision that I couldn't see that was distorting everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was my hard drive crashing just weeks after, probably more like months after I'd submitted the final manuscript for The Unholy Consult. All my meaning did die. Oh. I mean, my computer, which I had for 10 years, which had, you know, the content of all my other hard drives that I stashed on it when I bought the computer, it died on me, and it took a few months for them to reconstruct it, and I had to pay a bunch of money to get what they were able to salvage back. But for a while there, I didn't know if they'd be able to salvage anything. And just several weeks back now, I got the salvaged files back and discovered that everything I had written in the previous 6 months was what I had lost. And so what I'm concentrating on now is just basically rewriting all that stuff that I had written in the previous 6 months. So I had a huge review, not so much a review as a sort of commentary on Dennett, that I'm just finishing off now that I'd lost. I was actually a day away from posting it when my hard drive died. And, I also have a science fiction novel called The Lollipop Factory, which was over half completed, and I lost half the entire thing. Uh-huh. And I really, really like the idea. It's a great idea, and I want to. I know if I sit on it and, rather than dive into it, that it'll be much harder for me to salvage it. So I'm planning on digging back into that. And then getting right back into the second apocalypse and see where the words take me. Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck with the roads ahead, and thank you once more for taking time out of your day to chat with us about philosophy and consciousness and the coming whirlwind.
Yes, and the whirlwind. I thank a million, and if you could do me, I don't know if I should say another favor or whatnot, but spend some time on this AI stuff, because, you know, it's one of those things, you know, I could be wrong. I don't think I'm wrong, right? I mean, it is, after all, just philosophy, but if I'm right, we're and we will be in, we will be in short order. And things, you know, as weird as things seem now, I mean, everybody feels that we're standing on technological marvels as it is, right? It is going to get strange so fast. And people aren't really going to understand what's happening because they don't have even the merest sense of just how ecological, you know, the relationships to one another and to the society as a whole are, you know, how much they depend on these Darwinian buttons, you know, not being commercially exploited by active, interactive, artificial, invasive species. You know, there'll be billions of these things in our lives in very short order. So if you guys, if you can find anyone else who's, like Neil Lawrence, give Neil Lawrence a call.
Okay.
Yeah. So he'll blow your mind.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you.
All right. So there you have it. Thanks again to Scott for coming on the show and talking with us. Make sure you check out the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com, because I'll make sure to include links out to Scott's website, his social media presence, where you can find out more about his books if you're not already familiar with them.
So I haven't read the Second Apocalypse books, but now that I've had them spoiled, I think it's time for me to jump right in at the beginning.
Well, I have to stress that if anyone else is out there is in your shoes and something's been spoiled for you, these books are not like twist dependent. I mean, the
right.
twist is pretty great and really grabs you by the heart. But the books are rich enough, the world is rich enough, and all the different stories that weave in and out of it, you know, are still going to have their potency.
Yeah, I mean, I read plenty of books after I've already seen the movie.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point, sadly, where I've actually started going to films and going ahead and checking the spoilers if I know the film is supposed to be particularly horrific or have anything that's kind of controversial. I'm like, I guess I'll check and just see what the thing is that I might not like, just to prepare myself.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've been to all the wiki pages for Mother and stuff like that.
Yeah, I specifically looked up the new film Mother to see if it was something I was going to be okay with seeing. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm on board with that.
Put a raincoat on your mind.
There you go. All right. Well, hey, if you want to check out more of what we do, again, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. Also, check out our various social media accounts. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram. And hey, on Facebook, we have that discussion module, a special group that you ask to join, and you'll get in unless
you're really odious.
Exactly. So check it out. It's a great place to have longer form discussions with other listeners and even with the hosts.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.